Hello, welcome to Science Journal, an audio journal production presenting articles of interest from science magazines, newspapers, and online resources on topics such as technology, health, and the environment. This program is supported in part by Cognex and the UMass Medical School. Today, I'll be sharing stories about why the New Jersey earthquake was felt several hundred miles away, then a hairy truth about your sense of touch, followed by what Benjamin Franklin learned while fighting counterfeiters, then resurrecting the lost Arboretum of Salem, then the scientist racing against time, and finally, what time is it on the moon? White House tells NASA to decide. I'm Doug Johnson. This first article is by one of my favorite science writers, Carolyn Johnson. It appeared in the Washington Post and is titled, Why the New Jersey Earthquake Was Felt Several Hundred Miles Away. Wendy Bohan, an earthquake geologist, was reading a budget report Friday morning at her home in Chesapeake Beach, Maryland, when she felt the unmistakable light shaking of an earthquake. The cat didn't wake up. The dog looked around. A plant swayed. The tremors traveled about 160 miles to Bohan's home from a 4.8 magnitude earthquake near White House Station, New Jersey. It was a moderate earthquake from a geological point of view, with similar-sized quakes happening frequently all over the globe. But it marked a relatively infrequent event on the East Coast, one that jostled people across the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast from their daily routines. More than 150,000 people reported feeling the New Jersey earthquake, some from several hundred miles away, according to the United States Geological Survey, which collects reports of shaking. While the number of reports reflects the population density of the area, it also highlights a fundamental geological difference between the tectonically active West Coast and the East Coast, which is covered by old faults that occasionally get reactivated. The underlying rock in the East Coast is old, cold, and dense, and the faults have had time to heal, meaning that seismic waves travel farther than on the West Coast, where the crust is broken up by faults. A 4.8 magnitude earthquake, quote, is not generally big enough to cause damage, but big enough to be widely felt, said Susan Hoof, a seismologist with the USGS. Once an earthquake happens, the waves travel more efficiently in the east than in the west. The crust is older, colder, and less broken up. That's something we've seen over and over. You put a 4.8 in California, and it won't be felt nearly as far as this one. Several geologists said that while an earthquake greater than 4 magnitude was not a frequent event on the East Coast, such events aren't unexpected. In 2017, a 4.1 magnitude earthquake struck near Dover, Delaware. A 2011 5.8 magnitude earthquake near Mineral, Virginia, was believed to be felt by more people than any earthquake in U.S. history and resulted in significant damage, including to the Washington Monument and the Washington National Cathedral in D.C. A 4.6 magnitude earthquake struck near Reading, Pennsylvania in 1994. The New Jersey earthquake, which struck at 10:23 a.m. Friday, was relatively shallow, just 3 miles below the surface. The investigation into the quake will continue, but Christopher Carchetti, a seismologist at the Carnegie Institute for Science in Washington, said a common cause of such earthquakes on the East Coast is the shifting of Earth's surface after being weighed down by ice sheets from the last ice age. Quote, it's otherwise an inactive fault, readjusting to the loss of the ice, most likely, Carchetti said. Huff said the region is generally considered a, quote, passive margin between North America and the Atlantic Ocean, meaning there's no active fault or plate boundary. but she notes that one of her colleagues calls it a passive-aggressive margin because it will occasionally bite you. Moderate earthquakes in the east are always uncommon enough to be interesting, Hoff said, noting that Fridays will be intensely studied. As soon as she felt the tremors, Bohan began counting down. Earthquakes unleash multiple kinds of seismic waves that travel through the earth at different speeds. Measuring the time between the first shaking and the next set of waves can give a rough estimate of how close it was, similar to measuring the time between a flash of lightning and the rumble of thunder. Bohan got to 8 seconds, so she knew that the epicenter of the quake wasn't very close. Then she began looking up local seismic reports to make sure she hadn't imagined it. It has long been known that earthquake shaking travels farther on the East Coast than on the West Coast. The USGS says earthquakes can be felt over an area 10 times larger on the East Coast. On the West Coast, quote, the rocks are warmer, so they are more active. They've experienced activity more recently, so they're warmer and will attenuate or absorb some of the seismic energy as they pass through that rock, Carchetti said. By contrast, the rocks are cold and brittle on the East Coast, and they transfer seismic energy much better than the West Coast. Friday's tremor is a reminder, Bohan said, that while people think of earthquakes as a West Coast phenomenon, they can happen anywhere. This next article is by another of my favorite science writers, Veronique Greenwood. It's titled The Hairy Truth About Your Sense of Touch. It was published in the New York Times. Researchers showed that cells in your hair follicles release important chemical messengers in response to gentle touches to your skin. When someone brushes a hand across your skin, it's like a breeze blowing through a forest of countless small hairs. Nerves that surround your hair follicles detect that contact, and very far away in your brain, other cells fire. Some of the neurons responding to light contact might make you shiver and give you goosebumps. Some might tell you to move away, or they might tell you to move closer. Scientists who study the sense of touch have explored which cells bear these messages, and they have made an intriguing discovery. Follicle cells triggered by hair movements release the neurotransmitters histamine and serotonin, chemical messengers linked to biological phenomenon as varied as inflammation, muscle contraction, and mood changes. The observation, reported in October in the journal Science Advances, lays the groundwork for tracing how gentle touch makes us feel the way it does. Studying hair follicles is challenging because they begin to decay soon after being removed from the body, said Claire Higgins, a bioengineering professor at Imperial College London and an author of the study. So she and her colleagues went to a hair transplant clinic. There they were able to look at freshly harvested follicles, which they gently prodded with a very small rod to stimulate touch. The scientists knew from work done by other groups that the neurons in the skin surrounding hair follicles are capable of sensing movement. Quote, when you brush your hair, you feel it because the sensory neurons are directly being stimulated, Dr. Higgins said. But they were curious whether the cells of the follicle itself, the tube from which a hair sprouts, could be contributing to some of the feelings associated with more gentle touch. Not all of the follicle cells had movement sensors, but some did. The researchers identified these and watched them carefully as the rod touched them. We found that when we stimulated our hair follicle cells, they actually released mood-regulating neurotransmitters, serotonin and histamine, Dr. Higgins said. Blocking the receptors for these neurotransmitters on nearby neurons meant that they no longer fired when the hair was stroked, confirming the link between the follicle cells and the neuron's response. Just because these neurotransmitters are associated with mood in the brain does not mean that they are linked to emotion elsewhere in the body, Dr. Higgins said. They are messengers, and the nature of the message they carry depends on which cells they are stimulating. But she points to research by Francis McGlone, a neuroscientist at Liverpool John Moores University in England, who has studied the rewarding feelings we get from touch. He and his colleagues have identified nerves in the skin that respond to gentle touch, generating that warm glow we get from human contact. Were the neurotransmitters being released by follicle cells in this study stimulating those nerves specifically? No one knows, but Dr. Higgins hopes future work will illuminate the identity of the cells the neurotransmitters target. She is curious how increasing levels of serotonin or histamine in the skin might change what happens in the brain at the other end of the transmission. In the tiny sheath of cells containing each hair, there may be answers to questions about something as fundamental as human connection. The follicle never ceases to amaze me, she said. And here's another interesting article by Veronique Greenwood. It's titled, What Benjamin Franklin Learned While Fighting Counterfeiters. It also appeared in the New York Times. Long before there were Benjamins in circulation, the founding father was all about experimenting with printing techniques as he worked on securing colonial printed currency. When Benjamin Franklin moved to Philadelphia in 1723, he got to witness the beginning of a risky new experiment. Pennsylvania had just begun printing words on paper and calling it money. The first American paper money had hit the market in 1690. Metal coins never stayed in the 13 colonies long, flowing in a ceaseless stream to England and elsewhere as payment for imported goods. Several colonies began printing bits of paper to stand in for coins, stating that within a certain time period they could be used locally as currency. The system worked, but haltingly, the colonies soon discovered. Print too many bills and the money became worthless, and counterfeiters often found the bills easy to copy, devaluing the real stuff with a flood of fakes. Franklin, who started his career as a printer, was an inveterate inventor who would also create the lightning rod and bifocals, found paper money fascinating. In 1731, he won the contract to print 40,000 pounds for the colony of Pennsylvania, and he applied his penchant for innovation to currency. During his printing career, Franklin produced a stream of Baroque, often beautiful money. He created a cast of a sage leaf to print on money to foil counterfeiters. The intricate pattern of veins could not easily be imitated. He influenced a number of other printers and experimented with producing new paper and concocting inks. Now, in a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a team of physicists has revealed new details about the composition of the ink and paper that Franklin used, raising questions about which of his innovations were intended as defenses against counterfeiting and which were simply experiments with new printing techniques. The study draws on more than 600 artifacts held by the University of Notre Dame, said Kachatur Manukyan, a physicist at that institution and an author of the new paper. He and his colleagues looked at 18th century American currency using Raman spectroscopy, which uses a laser beam to identify specific substances like silicon or lead based on their vibration. They also used a variety of microscopy techniques to examine the paper on which the money was printed. Some of what they observed confirms what historians have long known. Franklin's paper money contains flecks of mica, also known as muscovite or isinglass. These shiny patches were most likely an attempt to combat counterfeiters who would not have had access to this special paper, said Jessica Linker, a professor of American history at Northeastern University, who studies paper money of this era and was not involved in the study. Of course, that didn't stop them from trying. Quote, they come up with some very good counterfeits with mica pasted to the surface, Dr. Linker said. In the new study, the researchers found that the mica in bills for different colonies seems to have come from the same geological source, suggesting that a single mill produced the paper. The Philadelphia area is notable for its schist, a flaky mineral that contains mica. It's possible that Franklin, or printers and papermakers associated with him, collected the substance used in their paper locally, Dr. Manukyan said. When they examined the black ink on some of the bills, however, the scientists were surprised to find that it appeared to contain graphite. For most printing jobs, Franklin tended to use black ink made from burned vegetable oils, known as lamp black, said James Green, librarian emeritus of the Library Company of Philadelphia. Graphite would have been hard to find, he suspects. So Franklin's use of graphite in money printing is very surprising, and his use on bills printed as early as 1734 is even more surprising, Mr. Green said in an email. Could using graphite ink have been a way to differentiate real money from fakes? Differences in color between graphite and lamp black are likely to have been subtle enough to make that a difficult task, Mr. Green said. Instead, we may be looking at another example of Franklin's creativity. It suggests to me that almost from the start, he was using his money printing contracts as an opportunity to experiment with an array of new printing techniques, he said. To understand more clearly Franklin's intent, more analyses of printed documents from the era would be helpful, said Joseph Adelman, a professor of history at Framingham State University in Massachusetts. Quote, the comparison I would like to see would be Franklin's other publications, Dr. Adelman said. To really test this theory, does Franklin have this separate store of ink? In future research, Dr. Manukyan hopes to collaborate with scholars who have access to larger collections of early American paper money. These techniques can be quite valuable in the study of history, Dr. Linker said, if scientists and historians can work together to identify the best questions to answer. Quote, I have questions about a whole bunch of inks. There's a really weird green on some of the New Jersey bills, she said, referring to money printed by a Franklin contemporary. I would love to know what that green ink was made of. This next story is local. It was also written by Veronique Greenwood and appeared in the Boston Globe. It's titled, Resurrecting the Lost Arboretum of Salem. Decades ago, tree lovers with foresight planted an extraordinary collection in Green Lawn Cemetery. Getting to the bottom of it all has become a satisfying botanical mystery. An oak tree's life can span 1,000 years, an apple tree's closer to 200. To a shorter-lived organism paying attention, trees are messengers from the past. Some give evidence of people dead for decades. If you were in Boston, you are likely surrounded by Norway maples, which were embraced by planners after Albert Peel, an influential landscape architect, called them, quote, city trees in a 1915 manifesto. Their graceful, globe-like shapes adorn most Boston neighborhoods today. In the 1960s, thousands of honey locusts were planted across American cities, their fanning fronds turning yellow each fall, and today they make up more than 40% of the street trees in central Boston. Even in forests, trees can carry messages of human habitation. In 2016, ecologist Robert Warren published a paper suggesting that ancient honey locusts in the southern Appalachians were planted by Cherokee peoples before Andrew Jackson forced them off their lands. What Lisa Delisio noticed first when she examined the trees of Green Lawn Cemetery in Salem was their beauty. A professor of biology at Salem State University, she was looking for a place to train her students in botany, which includes identifying plants. The rambling 55-acre burying ground is lush with towering greenery. Its fairy tale canopy of leaves is beloved by many who live nearby. In the spring, surprising blooms can be spotted among the branches. In the winter, stately conifers hold chilly vigil. But Delisio realized when she took a closer look, these trees were no commonplace plantings. They appeared to be from all over the world. Among oaks alone, there were many varieties she had never seen before. Some of the more outlandish had leaves as big as hubcaps. What's more, a handful bore weathered labels, indicating that someone had once conceived of this place as an arboretum. Green Lawn's chapel records the generosity of a local philanthropist. The cemetery's stones record the deaths of sailors and poets, a black minister who was born a slave, and the Greek owners of a candy store. Whose record, she wondered, were these trees? Delisio reached out to the Friends of Green Lawn Cemetery, a community group, to ask if she could bring her students to the cemetery to see and study the trees. To her surprise, Pat Donahue, one of the co-chairs, explained that they had been considering how to document the trees. Delisio was asked to a meeting and, quote, "At that meeting, someone pressed into my hand the 1942 plant list," she said. This singular document, unearthed from the library of the Peabody Essex Museum, records hundreds of plantings then extant in the cemetery. The 80-year-old typewritten list provided the only known detailed record of the cemetery's trees, but it gave no sign of when they'd been planted or by whom. A century or so ago, if you lived in the Boston area and were obsessed with trees, you were in good company. The Massachusetts Horticultural Society, which had united enthusiasts of rare apples and ornamental maples since 1832, had helped found Mount Auburn Cemetery and endowed it with an immense exotic plant collection. In the early 20th century, the Arnold Arboretum at Harvard launched more than a dozen expeditions around the world, collecting plants in China, Cuba, the Republic of Georgia, the Balkans, Indonesia, and elsewhere, and bringing them back to Boston to grow. Naturalist E. H. Wilson, who later worked for the Arnold, was sent by a private nursery to China in 1900 to search for the dove tree, a gorgeous thing whose large, otherworldly white flowers were known in the West mainly by rumor and from dried specimens. Thanks to his work and the work of a competing French naturalist, the dove tree was grown in Western gardens for the first time. Tree mania seems to have come late to Green Lawn, however. Photographs taken sometime before 1914 show a bleak, bare sward. As late as the early 1930s, there are very few trees, says Chris Burke, an attorney and local historian who has researched the cemetery's history, drawing on photographs held in the Boxford Historic Document Center and other sources. To produce today's striking landscape, something dramatic must have happened. In the records of the Cemetery Commission, there's a clue. Quote, "An effort has been made to soften and relieve the barren appearance of the cemetery," the 1934 annual report reads, "by planting 214 conifers and evergreens, 134 deciduous trees, 120 flowering trees, 571 deciduous shrubs, 100 broadleaf evergreens, 171 vines and perennials. The 1935 report picks up the story. Quote, a large assortment of seeds of shrubs and trees has been received from the Arnold Arboretum, which we have planted with a view of raising for ourselves some of the unusual and interesting specimens. As Salem struggled through the Great Depression, someone at Green Lawn Cemetery was imagining a future where these twigs would be trees. Tantalizingly, a dove tree appears on the 1942 plant list. The notes say that in that year, it was about 5 feet tall. There, the human records end, however. Floods wiped out some of Salem's civil documents, which tended to be kept in municipal building basements. We don't have a record of what was destroyed, says Patricia Kelleher, the city's preservation planner. Memory has failed us. Only the trees remain. On a recent fall morning, Delisio and Christine Lutz, co-chair of the Friends of Green Lawn, led me to a pine tucked away on one side of the cemetery whose bark is a patchwork of red, green, and pale teal, an outlandish harlequin of a tree. It is a lacebark pine, a rare Chinese tree that appears on the list from 1942, when it was only 2 feet tall. Delisio, her students, and other interested people are working to identify all the cemetery's trees. To garner recognition from ArbNet, an international accrediting body for arboretta, a collection has to have at least 25 labeled types. So far, Green Lawn's list is more than 100 long. As to whose brainchild this collection might be, there are a few hints. The Cemetery Commission included a man named F. Carroll Sargent, who shows up in the records of the Arnold Arboretum as a frequent recipient of seeds. And the 1934 report contains this line, quote, the commissioners have depended to a large extent on the wide and valuable experience of Mr. Harlan P. Kelsey. The paths of these two men must have crossed by the early 1930s. F. Carroll Sargent, a masonry contractor, was the superintendent of Green Lawn, and the Cemetery Commission hired Harlan Page Kelsey, landscaped architect and nurseryman extraordinaire, to do landscape design and acquire plants, says Polly Wilbert, a volunteer researcher, writer, and tour guide who has worked to piece together the story. Growing up in Highland, North Carolina, Kelsey was 12 years old when he first wrote the catalog for the family nursery business. He lived and breathed trees, and in 1896, he moved to the Boston area. His nursery in Boxford specialized in rhododendrons, azaleas, and other hardy plants, including plants from the Arnold Arboretum. Chris Burke has found in his research in the Arnold's records that Kelsey was something of a power user. Quote, Harlan was getting an amazing number of plants, he said. Once you've heard of him, Kelsey crops up everywhere. He was president of the Appalachian Mountain Club. He worked for the establishment of national parks, including the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Kelsey should be remembered the way John Muir is, writes Lauren Wood, author of a Kelsey biography, quote, Beautiful Land of the Sky. Kelsey took pictures of his landscape design projects, some of which survive in the Boxford Historic Document Center. On December 22, 1935, men toil on the muddy shore of one of Green Lawn's ponds. Perhaps when Kelsey snapped the photo, he was imagining a future where the trees he'd put in would shade the banks. He died in 1958 when the trees were beginning to come into their own. No biography has been written of F. Carroll Sargent, who was the superintendent of Green Lawn for most of his adult life. He ran a very popular chrysanthemum show at the cemetery, where one of the ponds is named for him. He died in 1969 and is buried in Green Lawn. For a handful of months in 1948, however, Sargent wrote a series of newspaper articles about Green Lawn's plants. Reading them, you can almost hear his voice. He tells the story of the dawn redwood, a tree long known only from fossils and thought to be extinct. In 1945, Chinese botanists rediscovered it, alive and well in the Hubei province. The Arnold Arboretum has promised him a specimen for green lawn, he confides. Quote, it's a wonderful example, he writes, of the persistence of plant life. To the best of our knowledge, the knowledge of Wilbert, Burke, Delisio, and others who have worked to put this story together, when you look at many of the trees of Green Lawn Cemetery, you're seeing the marks, now grown tall and full, left by these two mines. Cedar of Lebanon, Siberian elm. The trees are getting names again, slowly but steadily and carefully. Delisio and her students are examining each tree to identify it. Not every tree on the 1942 plant list is still there today. The big-leaf magnolia, likely planted at Kelsey and Sargent's direction, is no longer living, nor is the Frazier magnolia, Burke says, but there are surprises. In his wanderings in the cemetery, Burke has discovered a young Frazier magnolia in a woody area, probably grown from a seed. What we have is a surviving collection and some echoes of the old collection now growing naturally, says Burke. In 2020, the cemetery was recognized as an arboretum by ArbNet. After decades of obscurity, the collection is now known as the F. Carroll Sargent Arboretum at Green Lawn Cemetery. It is administered through a collaboration among the City of Salem, the University, and the Friends of Green Lawn. The many oaks are a continuing mystery to Delisio. She has reached out to the International Oak Society for help in matching them with their names. The original dove tree on the 1942 list has not been spotted yet. It's possible it's hiding somewhere in the crowd, but it's a variety she is considering suggesting bringing back to the cemetery. Others have joined in the quest to identify Green Lawn's trees, often because they, too, have gotten hooked on the mystery of what was planted here so long ago. Those 214 evergreens and conifers, the 134 deciduous trees, and all the rest. The chair of the cemetery commission is eager to figure out the name of a majestic conifer whose cones, which could help identify it, are too high up to see clearly. Witch hazels of an unknown variety were putting out their yellow blooms recently, and Delisio hoped to use the flower shapes to tell what they were. Are there any dawn redwoods in the collection, those living fossils Sargent hoped he would soon get? There are, in fact, at least three, towering over their neighbors like leafy monoliths. The trees are still telling his tale. So I keep finding interesting articles by Veronique Greenwood. Here's another one from the Boston Globe, titled, The Scientists Racing Against Time. Ice cores, seeds, and plants all contain clues about Earth's past and its future, but that information will be lost without a cadre of nature archivists whose work is harder than ever. If all goes well, decades from now, some of Margit Schwikowsky's most recent work will be in a hole in the ground. Schwikowsky, a chemist at the Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland, and her colleagues hope to soon excavate a trench in the snow near the Concordia Research Station in Antarctica. They will inflate an enormous balloon within the trench, spread snow across the top, and wait for it to solidify. Then they will remove the balloon and, in the hole that's left behind, they will leave a precious record. Cores from up to 20 of the world's surviving glaciers, as many as they can reach before they melt. For most of her career, Schwikowsky has studied what is known as eternal ice, ice that has not melted for millennia. The air from long-ago versions of Earth is captured in bubbles in this ice, each one a tiny time capsule about the atmospheric composition and climate of the past. Across much of the planet, however, the eternal ice is no more. Just last year, when Schwekowski and her team were drilling on the Grand Combin Glacier, 13,000 feet up in the Alps, they struck a layer of frozen meltwater. Since their previous drilling trip, warming conditions had caused the glacier's upper levels to melt and drain through the lower levels, wiping out its record. Schwekowski, along with other scientists who are part of the Ice Memory Foundation, had been planning to put the Grand Combin core with others in the Antarctic ice cave. There it would have lain, untouched, until some future generation of scientists needed to ask questions about the former world. In the grand sweep of history, records that survive have been the exception rather than the rule. Most of the time, what happens is lost. Sand buries settlements, oceans flood the land, fire consumes libraries. Their information about what the world was once like draining away like a receding tide. But now, in an age of cataclysmic change, scientists are reaching out to the natural world and taking snapshots in hopes that in the future, whether it's next year or in hundreds of years, someone will be waiting and interested. The message in the bottle reads, "Here, take this. This is what it was like." In the still air of a big concrete room under a hill in Sussex, England, there's a quiet hum. Fans for a refrigeration system have kicked on to cool six chambers opening off the big room. Open a door and row upon row of glass jars gleam in the dim fluorescent light. Most contain thousands of seeds, some as small as a grain of sand, some shaped like feathers, some like hairs. Quote, "It's like a crazy pantry in there," says Eleanor Bremen, senior research leader at the Millennium Seed Bank at Kew Gardens. Living seeds of more than 40,000 wild plant species are held in stasis here. Each seed was collected by someone who waded out into the grasslands, paddled a boat into the jungle, knelt among the miniature plants of the Arctic Circle, or otherwise journeyed to where they hoped plants might still survive. Many wild plants are on the way out, with Kew estimating in 2020 that around 40% of species are threatened with extinction. To Joel Brady, a scientist who spent a decade hunting down the seeds of wild plants in Lebanon for the Millennium Seed Bank, the need felt so pressing that in 2013 she founded a national seed bank at the Lebanese Agricultural Research Institute. Quote, "From 2014 to 2018, my team and I were constantly on the move throughout the country," she says, "on collecting trips funded by the Crop Trust's Crop Wild Relatives Project. They plucked the seeds of wild relatives of many crops, including wheat and barley, which are native to the Fertile Crescent, placed some in their own cold storage, and sent some here to England. Seed banks can also send emergency backups of their collections to the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, built above the Arctic Circle by the Norwegian government as a storehouse of the world's seeds. Above ground, where the chilly March light filters into the Millennium Seed Bank facility, recently arrived seeds lie in brown paper envelopes, each seed paper-clipped to a description. Lucas tetensis reads one clip, revealing that it contains the seeds of a pert Zambian herb, with creamy flowers and dark leaves. In a nearby room, a technician is shaking something through a sieve. She is filling a little sack with ochre-colored seeds of an alder tree. Bremen explains that each sample is cleaned, x-rayed to see if the plant embryo within is intact, and then dried and frozen, a process that greatly extends the lifetime of the seed. "You're looking at tens to hundreds of years of storage," she says. Not all plants can be saved this way. Oak trees, notably, will not grow from a dried, frozen acorn. Scientists can supercool tiny fragments of a plant, like a dormant bud, in tanks of liquid nitrogen. With careful thawing and the right coaxing, these materials can be used to create a new plant. But it's a delicate process, requiring specialized handling and many steps. A dry, cold seed is a simpler way of bearing a plant species into the future. For as many plants as possible, a scientist will make an entry in the Banks Herbarium, a single card with a dried, pressed plant stuck to it, with its name, where and when it was collected, and by whom. Already, though, time grows short. Shakil A. Jatwa, curator of Pakistan's gene bank at the Bioresources Conservation Institute in Islamabad, has led more than 30 expeditions into remote corners of his nation. Sometimes when he arrives where there was once a stand of rare plants, there is nothing there, just fresh pavement. Quote, all lost because of roads, he says. In places where locals depend on the target plant for grazing their animals, it has proved impossible to collect mature seeds. By the time scientists are on the scene, the seeds have been swallowed whole. Bremen herself leads expeditions to collect the wild plants of the Arctic, where warming is moving more swiftly than anticipated, and even in the best of conditions, on any collecting expedition, it's hard to be sure that seeds will be ready and waiting when they arrive. In a film clip on the Kew site, she reflects, just before a trip, am I going to have a whole team of people out here and nothing to collect? As we emerge from the low bunker in Sussex, Bremen tells me about the people who designed the building, a generation of scientists who got the money and set the plans in motion more than two decades ago. Quote, the reason they built such a big space is that the structure should last 500 years, she says. I blink into the bright sunlight. It seems impossible that anyone could plan that far ahead. But then, that's the problem, isn't it? In a pair of rooms at Duke University, there are more than 825,000 plants, each one dried, pressed, and labeled. It's one of the largest herbariums in the United States, with specimens accumulated by botanists over the course of a century, all kept in steel cabinets in a space no larger than two basketball courts. The leaves of some plants show bite marks of insects that preyed on them before they were collected, a record of what lived alongside them. The collection samples were used by researchers around the globe. This past winter, Kathleen Pryor, a professor of biology who is the collection's director, was told the university would like her to get rid of it. Pryor was stunned. Quote, Duke University, in 2024, is celebrating its centennial. There are flags all over the place. There are all kinds of celebrations. And yet, at the same time, 100 years ago, is when the Duke Herbarium was established, she told me on the phone recently. It's really unreal that they are celebrating a centennial by throwing out the 100-year-old herbarium. The university, which has an endowment of $11.6 billion, cited costs as the reason. All the collection needs, really, is air conditioning, the salaries of a pair of collection managers, and oversight from a faculty member, Pryor argues. Quote, they're not fessing up to the fact that others want that space for something else, she says. But the herbarium has little protection against such shocks. It does not have its own endowment, a special pot of money the university is obligated to use for its maintenance. It was founded originally as part of a Department of Botany, which merged with the Department of Zoology in 2000. It is now administered through a Department of Biology, whose leaders may or may not, at any given moment, be sympathetic to its existence. The collection received money from Chisita Culberson, a retired Duke lichenologist, until her death last year. Pryor had a video call with a prospective donor, a wealthy alumnus who wanted to provide $1 million for an endowment, with Duke coming up with $2 million more. Her excitement that she'd found a way to ensure the collection's future was short-lived. The week after that video meeting, the university, quote, said they were closing us down, she says. They couldn't let us keep going when they wanted to be gone. The news has sent shockwaves through the community of plant biologists. There is no collection large enough to absorb the Duke Herbarium. So if the university does not reverse the decision, the archive will be fragmented. And that is a frightening prospect, Pryor says. She was speaking with Barbara Thiers, the former head of the herbarium at the New York Botanical Garden, who started a list of herbaria around the world called the Index Herbariorum, about such transitions. Quote, she has told me that often what happens is things just get lost. There it was, sitting there ready to be used for biodiversity studies by anyone, Pryor says, and it just disappears. In a dumpster, in a moldy back room, specimens are detached from their labels, detached from human knowledge. At the University of Arizona, a remarkable collection lived for many years under the bleachers of the football stadium. Millions of samples of tree rings that record the recent climate history of the earth. Quote, it was quite a mess. I was worried about termites, says Malcolm Hughes, the retired director of the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research, who arrived in 1986. Each ring in a tree can reveal whether the year it grew was a wet one or a dry one, whether it was hot or cold, whether there was a volcanic eruption nearby, what the atmosphere was like. The collection, in fact, was the linchpin of the modern system of radiocarbon dating. We know how old something from an archaeological dig is today because decades ago, scientists aligned the University of Arizona's tree ring record with historical time. The tree ring collection now has its own building, Hughes is relieved to report. In 2007, Agnes Hari, a social justice activist and philanthropist, came to its rescue. Quote, that really saved the collection. We moved into the new building just over 10 years ago, Hughes says. The collection is still yielding insights into the past. Right now, scientists are investigating how the individual cells within each ring can tell the climate and events of even smaller increments of time, months or weeks, not years. And it is still growing, with new samples added all the time. The fate of the Duke Herbarium is upsetting, unsettling. Quote, it's obscene, Hughes says, but without a long view, without money, lawyers, an institutional structure that outlasts any human life, an archive, even if it's as meticulously assembled and shelf-stable as one of the largest herbariums in the United States, can always evaporate. Margit Schwikowski and her colleagues have got 7 ice cores so far, 2 from Russia and 1 each from France, Switzerland, Italy, Svalbard, and Bolivia. They have tried to get permission to drill on Mount Kilimanjaro, but have failed, quote, for political reasons. Schwikowski says, this is sad because the ice on Kilimanjaro is really finishing, she says. In 10 years, it will not be useful at all. She and the others are planning next to go to North America, to the Eclipse ice field in the Yukon Territory of Canada. In the cave, the ice cores will need no refrigeration. There will be little need for maintenance. And there are many things that you can do now with an ice core that were not possible when she began her career. In particular, scientists have begun to analyze DNA kept frozen in glacier ice, providing a look into what was alive long ago. She hopes that in 20, 30, 100 years, there will be new techniques, new questions, new answers. And finally, here's an article about the plan to solve a problem I didn't even know existed. It's titled, What Time Is It on the Moon? White House Tells NASA to Decide. This was written by Adela Solomon and appeared in the Washington Post. The White House has directed NASA to establish a time standard for the moon as the United States races to return to the moon at a time when several countries, including China and Russia, and private companies have also set their sights on space. A memo Tuesday from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy outlines the Biden administration's desire, quote, to establish time standards at and around celestial bodies other than Earth, and instructs the space agency to develop celestial time standardization with an initial focus on the lunar surface by December 2026. The Unified Time Standard will be known as Coordinated Lunar Time, LTC, the memo says. A standardized time reference is needed because the moon has a weaker gravitational pull than Earth due to its smaller mass, meaning that time moves slightly faster on the moon than on Earth, on average 58.7 microseconds per day, with the additional periodic variations, the memo says. The project, first reported by Reuters, will be important because, quote, knowledge of time is fundamental to scientific discovery, economic development, and international collaboration that form the basis of U.S. leadership in space, the memo said. Quote, the clocks run faster on the moon, Catherine Haymans, the Astronomer Royal for Scotland and a professor of astrophysics at the University of Edinburgh, said in an interview. This is one of the beauties of fundamental physics. Crazy things happen. Haymans explained that, quote, the way we define time on planet Earth is with an atomic clock. Atomic clocks are affected by gravity, which means if you took the same atomic clock up to the moon, then in 50 years it would be 1 second faster than the atomic clock on Earth. So it's a very small change in time between the Earth and moon, she said. But as Einstein's theories of relativity explain, time is, quote, running faster on the moon than it is on Earth. According to the theory, time moves differently depending on where you are in a gravity field, with time moving faster where gravity is weaker. Timekeeping is an exact science for technologists, and in atomic time, a second is defined as 9,192,631,770 oscillations of a cesium atom. Separately, Haymans notes that a day on the moon, to include a day and a night, is also different from a day on Earth. A lunar day is 29.5 Earth days, she said. This means that on the moon, the sun is up for roughly 2 Earth weeks, and it's then dark and nighttime for roughly the next 2 Earth weeks. The White House memo says one of the key reasons for the standardization of time is due to the fact that the United States plans to return humans to the moon and develop capabilities to enable an enduring presence. NASA's Artemis moon program aims to realize the U.S. goal of returning astronauts to the moon for the first time in over 50 years. Artemis II aims to send a human crew around the moon, and its crew will include the first woman, the first African-American, and the first Canadian to fly on a moon mission. NASA hopes to launch Artemis III, involving a human moon landing, by September 2026. The time standardization comes as China, India, Russia, Japan, and others are also pushing for a greater presence in space. China, in particular, has said it aims to land its first astronauts on the moon before 2030. Private companies are also developing initiatives to send commercial spacecraft to the moon's surface and orbit for scientific research and mineral mining. Quote, U.S. leadership in defining a suitable standard, one that achieves the accuracy and the resilience required for operating in the challenging lunar environment, will benefit all spacefaring nations, the memo said, also noting that a unified time standard will be foundational to these efforts. Last year, the European Space Agency issued its own memo outlining the urgency of defining a common lunar reference time, acknowledging a new era of lunar exploration. Like the White House, it said it was no longer enough to base time on celestial bodies, on Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, which is widely used on Earth, and that a more accurate time reference is needed as use of the moon becomes more sophisticated and common. The standardization of timekeeping will also allow for more precision in spacecraft docking, data transfers, communication, and navigation, said Haymans. There would be chaos on Earth if we didn't all have the same time, and it might soon be the case on an increasingly busy moon, she added. Earth's moon is the brightest and largest object in our night sky and is about 27% the size of the Earth, according to NASA. It's always there in our lives. What's so beautiful about the moon is it's constantly changing. It never looks the same from one night to the other, says Haymans. If we want to safely work in that environment on the moon, we have to account for the fundamental different nature in time, Haymans added. She also noted one perk of potential moon time. With no need to maximize sunlight hours, there would be no need for daylight savings time there. You have been listening to Science Journal, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. If you have an idea for a topic to explore, please contact Audio Journal at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. I'm Doug Johnson. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is called The Naming of Cats by T.S. Eliot. The naming of cats is a difficult matter. It isn't just one of your holiday games. You may think at first I'm as mad as a hatter when I tell you a cat must have three different names. First of all, there's the name that the family use daily, such as Peter, Augustus, Alonzo or James, such as Victor or Jonathan, George or Bill Bailey, all of them sensible everyday names. There are fancier names if you think they sound sweeter, some for the gentlemen, some for the dames, such as Plato, Admetus, Electra, Demeter, but all of them sensible everyday names. But I tell you, a cat needs a name that's particular, a name that's peculiar and more dignified. Else how can he keep up his tail perpendicular, or spread out his whiskers, or cherish his pride? Of names of this kind I can give you a quorum, such as Munkerstrap Quaxo or Corripat, such as Bombalarina or else Jolly Roarum, names that never belong to more than one cat. But above and beyond there's still one name left over, and that is the name that you will never guess, the name that no human research can discover, but the cat himself knows and will never confess. When you notice a cat in profound meditation, the reason I tell you is always the same. His mind is engaged in a rapt contemplation of the thought of his name, his ineffable, effable, ineffable, deep and inscrutable, singular name. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. read by me, Nikki Whichelow. Thanks for listening. May your life be filled with poetic wonder.